Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest today is Don Lee. We'll be talking about his new book, a short story collection, The Partition. Don is the author of four novels and two short story collections, including The Partition. And he is also the winner of numerous awards, including the American Book Award and Edgar Award for the best first novel for Country of Origin. And Don, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here with you.
So, Don, your career at this point is bookended by short story collections.
Yeah.
So what brought you back to deciding for this particular book to be a short story collection?
Well, you know, I think that most people in publishing and writing know this, but I'm not sure if the general public does, is that publishers, nobody's encouraging you in publishing to write short story collections. You know, they want novels from you, from writers, because they're much easier to sell, have a broader audience. And, you know, indeed, after my last novel called Lonesome Lies Before Us, I started thinking or, you know, working on a new novel. And it was going to be a neo-noir novel, actually. And so I started working on it, but I got distracted by an idea for a short story. And it was because of this was in 2018. And I live in this neighborhood called Rogers Forge outside of Baltimore. And there was I heard of a controversy about that people had discovered that there were still covenants and the deeds on the books that restricted residents of Rogers Forge to whites only. And so, you know, immediately that spurred a lot on, you know, and of course that there were the Freddie Gray riots, right, in 2015 in Baltimore. And so so it gave me an idea for a short story that was set in this neighborhood. I mean, these covenants, there are actually a surprising number of them in a lot of different cities, and they are not, you know, enforced. People actually don't even know that they're there most of the time. And in Rogers Forge, at least, they were repealed. I think it was a year or two after that. But that gave me the idea. I wrote a short story. And then I had an idea for another short story, and I've been writing, you know, I wrote three between novels before, and I thought, well, you know, if I've got five stories, I don't really have that much longer to go to have a book. And it started coming together, that whereas my first collection, Yellow, all took place in one city or one town. This one goes all over the place. But, you know, I started connecting them with a, you know, hopefully a consistent voice.
And I want to, let me jump in here, because one of the things I noticed reading all the stories and, like, you know, trying to figure out where the connection is. And of course, I am going to start with something sort of off the beaten path, which is the first story in the book and the last story in the book is a hopeful romantic relationships. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was interesting. The first story with the director meeting a young woman who has lupus, but who's also a triathlete. And then the last story with an actor, we're in Hollywood in both cases, in a manner of speaking, who reconnects with his old girlfriend that used to live with him in California. He's really close to her daughter. But in both instances, the characters had longing. They never got over the woman. They never really got over the woman. And I thought it was interesting because it wasn't a fairy tale ending. Of course, nobody writes fairy tale endings anymore. I mean, that's just, you know, not what people do. But it was, if I may, hopeful. Maybe that's my imagination. So I thought it was interesting that you opened your book with that relationship, that kind of relationship, and you closed the book with that kind of relationship. Was that purposeful?
You know, the arrangement, I mean, with the last story, that's the third of a three-story cycle.
Right.
About the same character, covers his life for 45 years, at 14 years old, I think, at 39 and 59. And so that one, you know, I felt like I needed to put that in the back and the collection with it. But the first story, I sort of played around. I was indecisive about this, about what should be the first story of the collection, what should set the tone. And I think that one ended up to be people's favorites because of, I think, that first of all, you know, the question becomes not so much about, I mean, you know, one thing that we haven't said is that all of the stories are about Asian Americans.
Right.
And this story, I think people have found interesting because it's about intra-Asian sort of squabbles between different Asian Americans. And also, it was about somebody who, you know, seems like he might be a model minority, but that ends up to fail in his career. And so that eventually, you know, I thought this is a good one to put in front. But you're right, though, that it's a sort of gentle opening to the collection. Some of the stories are much harder hitting. And then there's a nice way to end it. And I think that, you know, it does kind of round things out, I think, with that more hopeful air.
So let's go back to that first story, because the director made, and I may not have this quote right, the anti-ethnic movie.
Right.
And at first, it goes over well. But then, and this is where we get into the intra-Asian issues, the lead actor is half Asian, and mm-hmm. he has all the success with the women.
Right.
And so, you know, you really do explore within this collection, you know, push back, you know, and it makes common sense, actually, push back against the notion that, you know, there's a monolithic Asian American culture or an Asian American mm-hmm. identity, and everyone agrees on everything. And what throughout the stories, you challenge at whether your characters are internally struggling with their identity or they are dealing with outside groups that try to limit what their identity is. You even have characters where they're told by somebody, wow, you really speak English well for someone who's Asian.
Right.
Of course, you know, this is a character, the Asian American characters, you know, he's American, born in America. So talk a little bit about exploring this intra-ethnic conflict, you know, the sort of, the word I came up with was liminality.
Yeah.
And that's a new word I learned recently, thanks to an author named Sergio Troncoso.
Yeah,
so being in that in-between space, and a lot of this, in my mind, some of these characters are in that in-between space.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very good insight. And that's why I named the collection The Partition, because, you know, all of these characters are straddling at least two worlds, sometimes even more. And they're all kind of in between cultures and languages and countries even. And but mostly in they're bifurcated in their identities. And so, you know, I think that's common to most Asian Americans. But, you know, particularly for me, it's, you know, strongly the case because, you know, so I'm a third generation Korean American. My grandfather was the one who immigrated to Hawaii, and my father was born there. But my father was in the U.S. military, and so he was first in the Army, and then he was an Air Force civilian. And at that time, he was stationed in Tokyo, where I was born. We lived there for 4 years. And my first 4 years, and I had a Japanese maid And I had two Japanese friends, Hoko-chan and Machi-chan, who lived next door. And so Japanese was my first language. And then we got transferred to Seoul, Korea. And I had to sort of stop and say, hold on a second. I'm not Japanese, I'm Korean. I started learning Korean. And then after a year, I was going to start the school on the Army base, the U.S. Army base, in 8th Army, at the DOD school. And so all of a sudden, I had to start learning English. And so then I had to think, okay, I'm not Japanese, I'm not Korean, I'm American. And so this is sort of the, you know, they call it actually third culture, culture syndrome. That a lot of military and diplomatic brats go through, where you just don't know where you belong. And so that's, you know, complicated by, you know, for me, it was complicated by race and ethnicity and then nationality. And, you know, I got that all the time. Like the question that when most people ask Asian Americans, where are you from? What they want to know is what's your ethnic background. But for me, you know, that was such a complicated question because the answer was very complicated here. And so, you know, that's kind of, I think that that's stuck with me, and that's something that I've explored in all of my books. You know, I think for most people of color, you know, it's the idea of trying to find belonging, trying to find, comfort, in, you know, in a broader, realm or a broader sense of the word.
Well, one of the things that struck me is how you took on these professions and you really write the profession of chef, where the protagonist works in a restaurant in Philadelphia. She goes home to Missouri to help her parents close down their restaurant. And you really get into the details of, you know, the Asian American mixing cuisine and how she cut things up and everything. And then the TV news reporter, I wanted to call that story vanity or vain, you know, something like that, you know, that Carly Simon song, "You're So Vain." You're so vain. And you really get into the nuts and bolts of that particular industry. Talk to me about how you do the research where I'm reading it and I'm like, I would think you're a former news reporter from reading that story. I would think you're a former chef from reading the other story. How do you get the details? How are you so, you know, I don't know if you're accurate, but it sounds so believable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I hope that I've gotten most things right. I do a huge amount of research. But, you know, most of the time, these are occupations that interest me. I mean, one of the things that, you know, I find when I'm talking to people, I'm fascinated by what they're passionate about. And a lot of times they're passionate about their jobs. Not always, of course, but there might be something else, a hobby, a certain kind of relationship, a place that they're passionate about. And so I'm always interested in people's jobs. And then especially if it's something that's a little off the beaten path. And then, you know, I'll start doing, and that actually leads me oftentimes to figuring out their character. If that they have certain kinds of obsessions or evasions when it comes to their jobs. But for the TV reporter, I had been on a show for the ABC local affiliate in Boston. And so and I got to know the one of the producers. And so I just, you know, peppered her with questions all the time about TV news. But the chef thing You know, I mean, I think that this exists a lot because of Anthony Bourdain. So many people, because of Anthony Bourdain, had an interest in food and restaurants and chefs. And so I got on that train a long time ago, where I've always been interested in cooking. I have watched a lot of cooking shows and picked up little techniques. But for this one, it was going to one particular restaurant called Serpico in Philadelphia, where they had a chef's counter where you could watch that with an open kitchen and you could watch the chefs working. And this is run by a fellow named Peter Serpico, who's a Korean adoptee, but he was David Chang's right-hand man at Momofuku, and then opened up this restaurant. Most of the time he was there and at the restaurant working. And so I would just like go there and watch the sous chefs and, the chef de cuisine and working and what they were doing. And so I was always just fascinated by that.
My favorite story and favorite character is Jay in Confidence.
Yeah.
Because you're rooting for him to do something. He finds out his girlfriend, who's a dean, an assistant dean at Johns Hopkins University. Maybe having an affair. At least that's what maybe thinking about having an affair with the guy she had an affair with before. Her best friend tells him. And so, that's what makes this, a juicy story, because her best friend tells him. She's also best friends to the guy that his girlfriend may be reconnecting with. He's 35, she's 39, but Jay just won't act.
Yeah.
Yeah. So talk about the creation of that story, because her name is it Solveig? How do you pronounce it? Solveig?
Solveig, yeah.
Solveig. Solveig. I really like that story.
That was the story I was talking about, what sort of spurred on the collection of Rogers Forge, right? This takes place in the neighborhood of Rogers Forge. But I think that, a lot of this came about because, we're talking about professions and he's a letterpress printer. He runs a little print shop, solo operation. And it was because I used to teach a class on journal editing for 19 years at Theater Plashers Magazine. I started teaching at Temple University, and he said, why don't you teach an editing class? And so I started showing them. I would talk about typesetting, and I would show them this video of a letterpress printer in Somerville, Massachusetts, who had this incredible way of speaking, this highly erudite and eloquent, just a beautiful voice. And so, I thought, I can have this character who is an apprentice, but let me, do something here where this is not an Asian American that you would come across. It certainly does not fit the model minority type, who used to be, a gang member at one point when he was a kid, and then just kind of bounces around and becomes a letterpress printer and becomes sort of a self-made intellectual, where he reads a lot. And so it was really that kind of profession and that sort of character that started this. But I think the fun of it was because, my wife they have a couple of friends and who are incredible gossips. They get in trouble because, one person says to the other, don't tell anybody else. But
but of course they do. And so, you know, that actually was part of it too.
He does make an interesting statement in this story. He says, "I have a confession to make here. I have never much cared for white people, which I suppose makes me a racist. This whole experiment of multiculturalism in the United States, the desire for integration and diversity, basically, I think it's a colossal mistake. It's never worked anywhere in the world at any time in history." What a bold statement.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not that I agree, but I'm like, whoa.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, one of the stories I like to tell a lot is, you know, after my first collection came out, Yellow, and I did a reading, and this young man comes up to me, and he says, "Oh, you know, I'm Korean-American, and I, you know, want to be a writer, and my question to you is, do I have to write about being Korean-American?" And I said, "No, because I'm doing that for you." And what I meant was, you know, we were at that stage where anything that we did, we had to discuss race and on a broader social, political kind of level. But, you know, we eventually we'd get to that point where people wouldn't expect Asian American authors to be writing about race. And so, that was 21 years ago, and we haven't made the progress that I had hoped, you know, on a literary level, but you know, also on a general level at all. And so, you know, I mean, you asked early on about what kind of spurred on this collection. And a lot of it had to do with the state of the country, you know, at that time, 2018, with the previous administration in the White House and what was going on, you know, first with the sort of backlash to the coronavirus and associating it, you know, the Chinese flu, Kung flu, that sort of stuff. And then all of the attacks on Asian Americans that started happening, going, you know, all the way up, culminating, of course, with the murders in Atlanta. But also it was connected to George Floyd. And you know, so, yeah, I mean, Jay has a cynical point of view about this, but a lot of people certainly do.
The story years later, which I think is your shortest story.
Yeah, definitely.
And it was what was interesting about it is how the characters you kind of blow up the notion of dreams. you know, you read it, you say, OK, they had dreams. And guess what? Didn't even come close to fulfilling those dreams. But What was your motivation to write that story? This, let's see, an Asian American who spent a year abroad in Tokyo meets a Japanese young man, and they know they're not going to stay together because, of course, she has to go back. But they talk about their dreams and their hopes. And so you write about that experience, but also project forward into the future. You did that with a few of your stories. Of course, the last
flash forwards.
The sort of the flash forward. So, So you really, I like the story, but I thought it was curious, this flash forward of, I don't want to say disappointment, because if, you know, if you like the path you took in your life, it doesn't necessarily mean you took the path you thought you were going to take at 19 or 20. Matter of fact, I would bet that most people don't take the path that they mapped out for themselves when they were 20 or 21 or 22.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. For me, I went to UCLA for undergrad, and I went in as a mechanical engineering major because I wanted to get my PhD in physical oceanography and build and pilot underwater submersibles. And so that was my original plan.
Wow.
And then halfway through at age 20, I became an English major and wanted to be a writer. And so, yeah, you never know what the turns of decisions and the fate that will befall on you. I think most people, they would have never imagined that, you know, their lives would have ended up the way that they did. And so that's a point that the character makes in that last story that we talked about earlier. This one, it is the shortest one, because that over the course of my career, my stories have gotten longer and longer. And, you know, some of them here are over 40 pages. But this one is about 6 pages or so. And that's because this is the oldest story. I forget, maybe it's like 15 years old. And then I rewrote it a lot of things to fit this book. But it was because, I was invited to this reading series, and, you know, the hostess was adamant that we read for no longer than 15 minutes. And she said, if you go longer than that, I will physically pull you off the stage. And it was a great reading series because this was, at the time that this was not usually done. It was in a bar, and there'd be a lot of sort of drinking and gabbing, and then there'd be a few readers, and with more drinking and gabbing in between. And so it was a very popular series. But I didn't have anything that, I felt like I could read in 15 minutes. So I challenged myself to write a short story that would be 15 minutes long, read. And so this is what came out of it. But I think that, a lot of it was just, I was thinking about, I was born in Tokyo, but I went back to Tokyo, from 14 to 18 years old. Japan is, the drinking age there is 20, but if you're just sort of, and they don't expect anyone to break that law. If you're bold enough, and especially if you're a gaijin, a foreigner, and you go to a bar at 14 years old, they will serve you.
Wow.
So, because they expect, that people are honest. So I started going to bars when I was 14. And so all of those places that are mentioned in that short story, they go to this restaurant called Tonkies, they go to a bar called Flashbacks. And they're just riding around the subway. We were just kind of like let loose, and at 14 years old, on weekends we'd just roam around the city by ourselves, and because it was so safe. There are a couple of ways I could tell you about this. That one, one night I was in Roppongi, which is a sort of entertainment area, right? And so I had an umbrella, and I was leaning against a street railing, and I hooked it on the street railing, and, I forgot about it. And then, I came back the next day, there it was. Nobody had taken it, even though it was raining. But then the other time I was on the train, I had a stack of LPs that I was selling to a friend. And going to school, and I put it on the top rack, on the train, and I get off and I go, I just forgot all of those records. And I just, to the conductor in my broken Japanese, I explained what happened, and he said, on your way home, why don't you check with the station master, because the train goes on a loop for an hour around the city. And sure enough, on the way home, I come back and the conductor had my albums. And so nobody had taken them, you know. And so it was a great high school experience, you know, you're in an international city and you're able to just freely roam about like that.
Well, Elaine was really obsessed with having sex with this girl. Let's get to that. At 14 or 15. Was that you?
I will neither confirm nor deny.
Not different than most 15-year-olds.
That's right. Yeah, but, you know, I mean, I actually say so, addressed it in a lot of stories. And it's really about nostalgia. And then, you know, comparing nostalgia with reality. And I think that I've come to write about that more because I'm older now. And whereas maybe with my first collection, it wasn't something that I was addressing so much. And so, you know, I am interested in that in terms of where you end up, where people end up in life, how that is different from where they thought they'd be.
Well, I really felt sorry for his father in this story. I believe this one was called the Sano. Because, I mean, the father was really browbeaten by the mother because he was a case officer in the CIA who just never seemed to get the break to move to the next level. They never got to live in what she would consider exciting locations. And that story was, you know, and also I saw a little bit of the Me Too movement in there, if I may say, you know, in terms of how the girl he was pursuing reacted to his advances. So, that story was a pretty complicated story. I mean, complicated in that the father being browbeaten by the mother, the young man maybe going too far. And what he's doing with the young lady and just so obsessed, so single-mindedly planning out getting her in bed that he didn't realize he was going too far.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, this was the second story I wrote after Confidants. And so, you know, if there are connections in the book, it's that each city occurs in two stories, at least two stories. And so years later, that took place in Tokyo, and then the Sano takes place in Tokyo as well. And so, you know, what this character goes through in staying at the Sano Hotel, which is a military transit hotel in Tokyo, I did that, where we ended up staying in this place for, you know, almost the entire summer while my parents were looking for an apartment for us to rent. And so that part of it is autobiographical. And the part about having a date and taking someone to an Eric Clapton concert, that was autobiographical, but the other parts of it were not. But I saw this a lot of, you know, my dad was at that point he was, he was still an Air Force civilian, but eventually he moved over to the State Department. But my friends, you know, at the American School in Japan, there were some people worked for a private American companies. Other people were from, you know, the UK or from Europe. But my friends were mostly people who were in the State Department. And, you know, as you probably know, a lot of people in the State Department are CIA officers. And yes. So, you know, even at 14, 15, it was interesting to see, you know, we didn't know that much about it, but we could sort of see the kind of internal office politics and how they were rooted in things like, dinner parties and cocktail parties. And so in his story, I say that, you know, they didn't know it at the time because his mother was a terrible cook, and they always, you know, had the food and everything catered, and he didn't know at the time, but there was actually, it could affect your promotions of, you know, how your spouse was as an entertainer and or as a hostess. And so that is something that I heard, and that really struck me, even at 14, 15 years old, about, you know, the pressure that you had within the diplomatic and intelligence communities, and the things that would affect your sort of chances of promotion. And, you know, of course, what you often saw was that it was, you know, particularly at that time, the people of color seemed to have a harder time to break through.
You address the issues of other people of color in the novel, especially in the story about the actor when he's on the set for the making of this movie. And I believe, you know, we have a African-American, we have a Hispanic-American, we have an Asian-American, and some of the off-color jokes that they tell each other. But one of the flashpoints of the novel is the protagonist hears the African-American director, writer, make a truly racist comment. And while among his little circle, they make racist comments to each other, but lightly, and him not knowing what to do. The lady he's dating, and I'll use that term loosely, because the relationships throughout this is really not the relationships throughout short stories is usually not permanent. I mean, it's a lot of casual relationships. We're only in it for a good time. I won't even go back to the Asian American reporter, you know, but her two lovers, But you address that. Jay talks about that issue also with African Americans and, you know, some of the things they face. So you're not just addressing in the novel Asian American racial issues, but also you dabble, to use that term, with other groups and what they face.
I mean, that's definitely the case because, I mean, it's what's interesting also, you know, between when we were talking about the first story, the intra-Asian kind of complications, but it's also complicated between, you know, groups of people of color. And, you know, that's particularly the case. There's a sort of a long-standing, conflict between Asian Americans and African Americans. And so, you know, that goes back, I think, to the Rodney King riots. Remember, I think it was in 1992, and then, you know, there were the riots in Koreatown in L.A., and, you know, the most typical thing about it is that the little kind of markets in New York City, and you hear that a lot where you have these Asian, Asian and Asian American owners who run the stores and the discrimination that they dole out to their black customers. And so, you know, my thought is, if we could only get together, band together, and fight all of this stuff, and not each other. But, you know, it's been interesting to me to see the evolution of this, because I think that, I think that with George Floyd's murder, Asian Americans came out very strongly in protest. And then with the Atlanta killings, Black Americans really came out strongly in support. And so, you know, I think that that has improved, but it's certainly been fraught with complications.
I want to go back to the Victoria, because even that's a very complicated story, because you start off thinking of her as just this vain reporter who has found sort of really wants to succeed in the media industry. And I'm trying to find this this quote here where she basically says, you can't be too ethnic to move up the ladder. So she's 100%, I believe, Korean American.
Yep.
But lets people believe she's half Korean because it helps her career. And I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. She's had all kinds of cosmetic surgery.
Oh, yes. But what I like the way you paired one of her lovers fully accepts his Korean heritage, culture, does not change his name. And I guess, you know, this isn't a crime fiction thing because the crime fiction authors never want you to reveal the plot. He can tell she had the plastic surgery.
Yeah, because he's the doctor.
But the backstory of how it got started for her is what I really like. The way it wasn't just her pursuing vanity, but, you know, what happened to her mother and her mother's inability. And then even then you complicate that story of what her father believes, why her mother committed suicide, as opposed to what really happened. So I like the way you sort of flesh out this character where that the start of this vanity did not start with them.
Yeah. You know, this was kind of, I wanted to write a parallel story from a female point of view to the title story of Yellow, which had a fairly harsh character, main character. And, you know, some of the reactions I got to that initially had been that this was an unsympathetic character. And I thought, you know, I like unsympathetic characters. I like reading about them. You know, it's interesting to me to have it where you don't have somebody who's just, you know.
Wait, I got to stop you here. There were a fair number of unsympathetic characters in this collection.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really pay attention to that. I mean, and in some ways, I feel like it's a challenge to write unsympathetic characters. You know, Jay is certainly one of them, the letterpress printer.
No, I'm very, hey, leave Jay out of this. Jay's my guy.
Okay,
all right. He's all trying to figure out, does his girlfriend, does he really belong with her? Because he's got a GED, you know, he's MMA, and he's being put in. It's a class. In many ways, it's sort of this class
story
issue.
About class.
Yeah.
That story is about class. Yeah, for sure. With plastic surgery, I mean, that might have been one of the things that I read about because, I don't know if you know this, but, Korea has more, plastic surgery than anywhere else in the cosmetic surgery than anywhere else in the world. And a lot of people, you know, from Japan go to Korea to get procedures. And so, and they do all kinds of things about bone sculpting and jaw sculpting. So it can get pretty severe. But one of the things that I read about was called a phrenectomy, which is that they snip, you know, the underside of your tongue has a little piece of tissue.
Yes.
Horizontal or vertical. And so one of the, you know, ideas had been that why some Asians, they don't pronounce their R's and then L's correctly is because of that piece of tissue. And so they had a cosmetics procedure where they would snip it. And so people would become more articulate and fluent in English. And I thought, that is a bizarre thing. I know that, you know, that is probably a fallacy, that it's not true. But then the other thing I found, too, was that there's another type of procedure, I forgot the name of it, that they would do over where they would snip some sort of tendon in your calf so that you wouldn't have these kind of bulges in the back of your calf there, that they would be smoother. And right. So, you know, all of the stuff that people do to mold themselves to become attractive. And but most of it is, you know, the question becomes, is it vanity or is it something else? Who is imposing these kinds of standards and these expectations? And, you know, is there something that's even deeper and more pernicious and organic in those desires? And so that's what I was stressing with that particular character, Victoria.
You talked about locations appearing twice in your collection, and the strangest location to appear twice in your collection was Colima.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, wait, between El Paso and Colima, because we didn't talk about this story, but this is a story about a young professor on a tenure track, Ingrid, in California, who translates a Korean novel into English. And that's the basis of her getting tenure. But then a professor out of Korea severely criticizes her translation and says she actually changed the novel. And the original novelist agrees, calls her up and wants to meet with her when she hears about what's going on. And where do they meet? In Colima, Texas.
Well, Colima, did you look it up and find that there is no Colima, Texas?
I didn't look it up, but I know there is a city, I forgot the name of, in Texas that's well known for being a writer's retreat. But it's not Colima.
It's not Colima. It's Marfa.
Yeah, Marfa. Marfa, Texas. Yeah. So is Colima stand-in for Marfa?
That's right. I spent 3 summers there. And so this was the first time was in 2010. And the Lannan Foundation, you know, they set it up where they had these writer's residencies in Marfa, and 4 writers at a time. And so they, you know, invited me to come for a residency. And I looked it up on Wikipedia, and I just saw this ghost town. And it's, you know, 2,000 residents, and it said it was 3 hours drive from anywhere. And I thought, oh, I wrote email back and I said, you know, I don't know if I can do this. And they said, well, you know, look at the roster of our former residents. You know, we're probably, you're probably friends with some of them, and ask them. And so I did. And they all said, stay as long as you can. And so I ended up staying there for 7 weeks. And so this is, you know, 2010. It still wasn't on the cultural map yet, Marfa. Now everybody knows what Marfa is, that it's a, you know, a hipster town, and Beyonce goes there for, you know, went there for a vacation. And so, you know, the secret was got let out. But at that time, nobody knew anything about Marfa. And there was this really sort of special feel to it. Like, I remember I had 100 pages of this novel, which ended up to be The Collective. And I was flying into El Paso and looking at the desert. And I had, my problem was, I had no idea what was going to happen with the rest of the book. And I was thinking, I'm going to be there for 8 weeks, and I'm going to have writer's block, and eventually I'm just going to walk out in the desert. and morose and suicidal. But then I got there, and the next day I got, you know, situated in the house. They give you this, you know, they have these beautiful houses all to yourself. And the next day I woke up and I figured out the rest of the novel. And then I the remaining time, the, you know, 8 weeks, you know, I wrote the next 150 pages.
Wow.
Finished the first draft. And so, you know, people kept on saying, there's something about this place, this sort of mystical energy, you know, about it. And it was cool because it's like this, I mean, there you know, at that time there were two pretty good restaurants, but not much else. And but they had this reading series. They had a NPR station, and they had a lot of music. And so, you know, you had a bunch of artists who were obviously all too with Donald Judd's foundation there, a bunch of painters and sculptors as well. And so, you know, the vibe of that place was incredible. I just loved it, and it was really productive. And so, but I didn't want to write Marfa because I wanted to be able to depart from, you know, the facts. And so I called it Colima instead.
Well, I tell you, Ingrid, is in the name of the short story, it's your third story in the collection, it is a partition. And she is as nebulous in terms of identity as you can be, and wonders why people want to try to classify her. So I think, you know, with your collection here, you give sort of all these different views on identity, not just a view, but just such a wide variety, because people are making different choices based on their background. And you write, even her sexual orientation was a fuzzier matter, almost asexual, maybe.
Yeah.
So what was the source of this story, other than the fact that you spent time in Marfa?
Yeah, you know, a lot of it was because of, did you ever read The Vegetarian?
It's I didn't read
Korean,
that.
Yeah, Korean novel. And I forgot when it came out, but it won the Man Booker International Award, which is given for the best foreign novel that's translated into English. And the interesting thing about that award is that it's given to both the author and the translator. And the translator for this book was at that time a young woman named Deborah Smith, and she was 32, and she'd only started learning Korean 6 years before. And this was her first translated book. And so, as you were talking about in summarizing this book, you know, happened to her where she got into trouble because there were these scholars and others in Korea who'd said, "Wait a minute, you know, this translation is not only erroneous but also immoral because it makes things up that aren't there in the book, and it changes the book entirely." And so I got really sort of fascinated by this idea. I mean, first of all, what, you know, in an interview, what Deborah Smith said was, there's a term for this. It's called fidelity in translation. And she said that, you know, you can never have true fidelity in a translation, because if it were going to translate something literally, it'd be gibberish, which I think is right on. But then she also said all translations have to be an act of creative writing. And so I thought, I'm not sure about that. And but, you know, I think that what you got to do is you have to somehow honor the spirit of the work. And, you know, I think that she did that with, or at least the author, Hong Kong, agreed on that and supported the translation. But, you know, that whole controversy really kind of interested me. And then it was about this issue about getting tenure and at a university. You know, I taught at a small college called McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota, for just a year. But after I left, there were a couple of instances of people getting denied tenure and people I'd known. And so, and it became, you know, lawsuits and stuff like that. And so I thought, you know, people might be interested in the sort of ins and outs of this whole process that they don't know anything about, both in terms of academia and translation. But it goes to the whole sort of theme of translating your own identity. Is that possible so that it's known, you know, in a different country, in a different culture, especially in a different language?
Well, this has been quite a delightful discussion, Don Lee, author of The Partition, and I really did enjoy this book. And be kind to Jay. that character just, you know, we're, you know, I was cheering for him to confront his girlfriend. Yeah. And he didn't get quite there. And maybe he went a little too far with Charlie Rusk.
Yeah, a little bit too far, maybe.
Yeah, but, you know, he's the underdog.
That's right.
You know, there's the old story about when someone sees a super good looking young lady who's very successful with a guy, they say, boy, he's swinging above his weight. But we cheer for the underdog to swing successfully.
That's right. Everybody loves the underdog.
Above his way. So what do you have coming up next, writing-wise? What's next?
Well, I think I'll have to go back to that neo-noir novel that I was supposed to write before I started getting distracted with these stories. And yeah, that's going to be, I don't think it's actually even going to take place in the United States. It's going to hop around, but have more sort of a global thing and a globe-trotting kind of affair. And so, and what I'm going to try to do, like I said that I was writing these, you know, plus 40-plus page stories. My novels are usually around 350, somewhere around there, always about 300 pages, but I've been interested in short novels that are under 200 pages. And in fact, I just taught a class at Temple on a contemporary short novel, and so, which I think is a real sort of art. And so that's what I'm going to try to do. Short neo-noir novel.
Well, will you come back if I want to talk to you about Country of Origin?
Absolutely.
I'm going to have to go grab that book. Is it on Audible?
Jeez.
I'll track it down.
I don't remember if it is. I don't remember. It might be, but I'm not quite sure.
I might. If I find it on Audible, we may, part of the discussion may be a critique of whoever reads.
That's right.
Well, thank you so much, Don Lee, author of The Partition. What's your website address?
It's don-lee.com.
Thank you so much.
Don-lee.com. Thank you, Hope. And this has been a delightful conversation. It's been a lot of fun talking to you, especially as somebody who's you know, such a careful reader of the stories. It's been a pleasure.
Well, let me just say this. I enjoyed all the stories. I mean, it really flowed for me. So it was very, very enjoyable. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast edition of Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.